Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, this Tuesday, July 7th, 2026, for our Commodities and Energy edition.
Today, we are examining how the massive capital requirements of the AI infrastructure buildout are fundamentally reshaping global tech sector rotations. We are moving away from a period of pure software scaling toward a structural necessity for massive, hardware-intensive physical capacity.
So the bottleneck isn't the code, it's the power and the chips.
The pattern is clear. The era of asset-light expansion is hitting the hard reality of energy constraints.
We begin by looking at the escalating demand for specialized silicon and the resulting shift in the tech landscape. Meta is planning a 5-gigawatt cluster in Louisiana that is enough power to run the entire state of New Hampshire just for one single data center project. We are talking about the massive, unprecedented scale of the AI infrastructure buildout and the tectonic shift in where the money is actually flowing.
It's a scale that defies traditional utility planning, Maya. We're seeing a massive capital expenditure cycle where the hyperscalers, the Googlers, Microsofts, and Amazons of the world are essentially engaged in a non-negotiable arms race to secure compute and energy.
A non-negotiable arms race. That sounds like something out of a mid-budget sci-fi thriller, but it's actually just a massive balance sheet problem.
And the financial implications are moving from the software layer into the very bedrock of the credit markets. FICC Focus noted that a structural releveraging wave is underway in investment-grade credit, driven by these unprecedented CapEx requirements. We are seeing high-quality companies move away from positive cash balances toward a much thinner profile of cash breakeven and flat net debt to EBITDA.
So instead of just buying back shares and sitting on piles of cash, these tech giants are starting to look a lot more like, well, utility companies, burdened with massive debt to build physical infrastructure.
That's precisely the risk. There is a real fear that we are heading toward a success paradox. If this rapid technological advancement leads to deflationary pricing power, meaning the cost of tokens or intelligence drops so low that you can't recoup the cost of the hardware, it could trigger a credit crisis similar to the 2012-2016 U.S. shale bust.
Ah, the shale moment. We build all this capacity, the supply finally catches up, the price of the commodity crashes, and suddenly all those highly leveraged infrastructure assets are just very expensive, very heavy paperweights.
It's a massive possibility. Even Bloomberg surveillance suggested the industry faces a potential fiber optic moment, where these massive, preemptive buildouts could lead to long-term excess capacity, much like the glut of fiber optic cable that crashed the market in the early 2000s.
Which would be a spectacular way to turn a $1 trillion investment into a graveyard of glass and silicon. But let's look at the now. The money isn't just staying in the big names. We're seeing this massive rotation happening right in front of us.
The Magnificent Seven dominance has officially broken down. As of June 2026, the narrative that Apple, Nvidia, and Tesla would carry the entire S&P 500 has fractured. We're seeing a transition where the Magnificent Seven has effectively turned into the Lag Seven, with the group actually underperforming UK government bonds year to date.
So the giants are losing their luster, and the money is scurrying into the corners of the market.
It's a structural rotation. Bloomberg Surveillance reported that capital is migrating from overextended bubble-like formations in semiconductors, where only 15% of names remained above their 20-day highs, into oversold, upward-trending sectors like healthcare, financials, and industrials. We are even seeing the semiconductor theme move down the cap-size ladder, shifting from the giants into small-cap names like MaxLinear, Eicher, and UltraClean. In fact, small-cap IT in the S&P 600 has seen nearly 60% growth this year, dwarfing the S&P 500's modest 7 to 8% increase.
So the brains of the operation are moving to the smaller, scrappier players. But if the software is getting smarter, the physical requirements for that intelligence are getting much, much hungrier. And not just for chips, but for electrons.
That is the massive mismatch of velocity that defines the current energy crisis. Data center developers are operating on a 1 to 2 year build cycle, but the power system requires a 10-year lead time to energize new transmission lines. We are seeing massive, concentrated loads, like the Hyperion cluster in Louisiana, that behave more like single large generators than traditional customers.
And I imagine the grid is not particularly happy about having a customer that can swing from 450 megawatts to 7 megawatts in 36 seconds.
It's a nightmare for operational stability. The existing grid simply wasn't engineered for that level of volatility. And while there is a lot of focus on the sheer volume of demand, we're talking 100 to 400 gigawatts. The real driver of the price spikes we're seeing in 43 different U.S. states isn't just the load itself. As the Columbia Energy Exchange pointed out, the real culprits are fuel price volatility and the massive inflation in grid components. The cost of wires and cables has surged 150% since 2019.
So it's a perfect storm: expensive hardware and aging grid, and a sudden, massive demand for power that arrives way faster than the utility companies can plug it in.
There's also a growing political friction. We are seeing a new era of Bannonism, a radicalized form of NIMBYism, where local communities are pushing for absolute moratoriums on new data centers due to concerns over water, noise, and pollution. We're already seeing the emergence of localized AI taxes on data centers, much earlier than the 2028 timeline many analysts were forecasting.
It's the classic move fast and break things strategy, running headlong into please don't let the electricity bill ruin our town. But is there any version of this where the tech giants actually solve the problem they're creating?
There's a silver lining in the way they approach procurement. The Columbia Energy Exchange noted that data centers might actually be the most efficient path to a final investment decision for clean, firm power developers. Hyperscalers are uniquely price insensitive and under extreme pressure to scale, which means they can act as the underwriters of the energy transition. If they leverage their massive balance sheets to fund geothermal or advanced nuclear, they could move from being a cost to the grid to being the primary driver of its modernization.
Even if they are technically more efficient, they're still driving the demand. We've seen Google manage to decouple operational emissions from load growth recently, reducing emissions by 2% despite a 37% jump in electricity demand, thanks to a massive reduction in the energy intensity of AI prompts.
That's the efficiency play. But the macro risk remains. We are currently in a K-shaped economy sustained by a single engine, AI-related capital expenditure. If that engine stalls, if the unit economics phase we're entering fails to prove that the cost of these tokens can be justified by real revenue, the whole structure becomes vulnerable.
And the market is already looking for the exit door. Macro Voices pointed out a significant vulnerability in the S&P 500 right now, because a massive one-week covering of 150,000 short contracts has effectively removed the cushion of shorts that would normally support the index during a dip. If the semiconductor names start taking profits, there isn't much left to stop a deeper slide.
We are moving from the era of free experimentation into a period of rigorous, high-stakes monetization. The industry has to prove it can generate observable revenue from this $1 trillion capex projected for next year, or we're going to see a very painful period of demand destruction.
Investors in investment-grade credit need to rethink their exposure to the hyperscalers as their debt-to-EBITDA profiles flat out.
We'll be watching the next round of quarterly earnings from the mid-cap semiconductor names to see if the rotation is truly structural or just a temporary pause.
But if the energy requirements for all this computing are going to keep scaling like this, we eventually have to look at the even more volatile bottlenecks in the global energy supply chain. 12 million barrels a day. That is the volume of crude currently jailbreaking out of the Strait of Hormuz. To put that in perspective, that is nearly double the rate of new oil actually being loaded onto tankers right now.
It sounds like a massive supply glut, but if you look under the hood, the math is actually quite terrifying for the energy markets. We are seeing a massive outflow of oil from the Middle East, but it's being driven by the depletion of floating storage and the use of alternative routes like Fujairah, rather than a surge in new production.
It's not a surplus, it's just a very large, very expensive liquidation sale.
The data tells a story on Macro Voices. Rory Johnston explained that the market is experiencing a deceptive supply surge because outbound flows of roughly 12 million barrels per day are significantly outstripping new loadings, which are stuck at around 5 to 6 million barrels per day. This creates a massive mismatch. We are seeing a shift into contango for both Arab Light and Brent because there is excess oil being produced, but it literally cannot be sold because the logistics are broken.
And by broken, you mean the peace agreement we've been hearing about since late June.
It's a very fragile kind of peace. We are moving from an active conflict into what looks like a Cold War standoff. The US-Iran Memorandum of Empathy, or MOU if you prefer, is being tested daily. Iran can't exert fine-tuned maritime control, so they are using drones and kinetic attacks as their only way to communicate consequences.
Right, because nothing says we are committed to diplomacy like a sudden swarm of drones near a VLCC.
It's psychological warfare. As noted in Straight Talk, Iran is essentially using PR-driven misinformation, like misrepresenting an old vessel grounding as a new maritime accident, to convince the world that alternative routes are still too dangerous to use. They want to maintain the perception of risk to keep their leverage.
So the tankers are basically playing a high-stakes game of hide-and-seek.
They are. John Ollett reported that while the IMO-established Omani route is technically paused due to safety concerns, many vessels are simply continuing to transit the area, often with their AIS, their automatic identification systems, disabled. They are sailing dark to avoid being targeted, which means ship owners are prioritizing Iranian sanction permission over international safety designations.
Which brings us to the price. WTI is hovering near $67 to $70, and the headlines are screaming about a price collapse. Is the oil jailbreak actually working to lower costs?
It's working for the headline price, but the underlying structure is decoupling. Argus Media pointed out that the US-Iran peace agreement and the reopening of the B-sphere risk have actually decoupled energy costs from polymer pricing. While the geopolitical risk premium has dropped, lowering oil and propylene prices, it hasn't helped PVC prices because weak global demand and high inventories are simply too heavy to move.
So the raw materials are cheaper, but nobody is buying the plastic.
And while crude is dropping, there is a massive divergence emerging between crude and refined products. We are seeing exploding diesel and gasoline crack spreads, approaching all-time highs relative to crude prices, which reveals a structural refining bottleneck. The market is tight on products even as it feels flooded with crude.
It's like a massive influx of grain into a port, but no one has any flour or bread ready to sell.
That's a good way to frame it. Even the volatility we saw in early 2024 and early this year was driven more by the fear of trapped supply in the Gulf than by actual physical depletion. Once the market realized how much supply was actually accessible, the high sulfur crack spreads crashed back into negative territory.
But if the U.S. keeps promising to guard the lanes, the Gulf states might start looking for a different bodyguard.
That's a very real possibility. There is a growing sentiment that if the U.S. commitment to maritime security in the Strait wavers, the UAE might pivot toward infrastructure-led energy independence. We could see a massive push for pipelines designed specifically to bypass the Strait entirely.
Or we just see the emergence of a high-cost ferry service model.
That's exactly what is emerging. We are moving toward a new normal of shuttle logistics, where tankers move oil from the Strait to waiting vessels in a safer zone, rather than direct long-haul flows. There is even talk of a shift from tolls to service fees, using the Omani model of charging for environmental protection and navigational assistance to bypass the political friction of transit rights.
It sounds like a lot of expensive ways to move the same barrel of oil.
It is.
And we have to remember that this jailbreak of barrels is being sustained by the drawdown of long-stranded oil. This cannot be maintained beyond 1 to 2 weeks without new production hitting the market.
So the window for this cheap oil is closing fast.
Very fast. Especially with the Iran-Oman MOU provision regarding regional administration of the Strait set to expire on August 21st. If we don't see a new framework by then, the Cold War could easily turn back into a hot conflict.
Investors in the tanker fleet need to watch that August deadline for any sign of renewed maritime enforcement. Keep an eye on the AIS data for the Omani corridor to see if ships start turning their lights back on. But if we can navigate these maritime choke points, does the real challenge lie in how we replace the carbon in them? If we can successfully transition the entire global energy grid from fossil fuels to renewables, solve the intermittency problem with massive batteries, and decarbonize long-haul aviation with plant-based fuels, then I suppose we could also successfully teach a golden retriever to perform open-heart surgery.
I'd settle for just getting the Western U.S. power grid to work without a nervous breakdown. We're looking at the great energy transition today, specifically how we're moving from short-burst battery storage to sustainable aviation fuel.
It's a lovely vision, but the plumbing seems to be breaking. I'm hearing about massive fees, outdated permits, and a grid that's basically just a collection of disconnected wires.
It's more of a structural reconfiguration. Since the launch of CAISO's extended day-ahead market in May, we've seen the Western U.S. moving from a reactive, real-time balancing model toward a proactive, day-ahead framework. The shift is intended to optimize transmission and resources across 12 states, with the goal of moving toward a network-style dispatch model.
So we're moving from oops, we need more power right now to let's try to predict the power we need tomorrow, provided the equipment we buy today isn't obsolete by the time the permit clears.
That regulatory lag is the real killer. Redefining Energy noted that the gap between 3-year permitting cycles and rapid tech advancement creates a massive risk of stranded economics, where the hardware you ordered for a permit becomes suboptimal before construction even begins.
And that's not even mentioning the costs. I assume the optimization comes with a hefty price tag.
It's getting expensive.
Redefining Energy reported that German grid connection fees are now averaging $100,000 per megawatt. But the silver lining is that the asset class itself is maturing. Battery technology is transitioning from a specialized high-risk frontier to a boring standardized asset class because predictable degradation patterns allow for more conventional insurance and financing.
Boring is a great word for an investor, but I'm still seeing a lot of complexity in how these batteries actually function.
The complexity has moved to the software layer. The interface matrix, integrating cloud management, battery management systems, and energy management systems, is now the primary driver of bankability because most faults are now resolvable via software rather than physical intervention. We're also seeing a shift toward 4 to 8 hour durations to achieve baseload-like stability, moving away from the old 1 to 2 hour models.
Fine, so the batteries are getting smarter and more boring. But what about the planes? We're essentially trying to fly jumbo jets on what amounts to highly processed vegetable oil and leftover beef fat.
It's more strategic than that. In the LATAM markets, particularly Brazil and Mexico, the focus is on carbon intensity rather than just volume. Argus Media highlighted that Brazil's mandate shifts the focus to carbon intensity, effectively turning the market into a competition of fuel efficiency. This allows for a feedstock-agnostic market that rewards high-performance decarbonization.
As long as the fuel is low carbon enough, it doesn't matter if it comes from soy, corn, or a pile of waste, provided we don't accidentally eat the feedstock.
There's a signal here the industry is moving toward second-generation soy, using the safrinha or second harvest to increase oil yields without expanding the agricultural footprint, which helps bypass indirect land use change risks. But Mexico is a different story. They have food security constraints that prohibit corn-based ethanol, so they'll likely rely on imports until they can scale domestic biorefineries using sugarcane or waste.
It sounds like a beautiful, complex web of carbon credits and biodiversity targets, until someone realizes we're double counting the same ton of carbon in two different regulatory systems.
That is the massive systemic risk. Argus Media warned that the lack of alignment between Brazil's Renova Bio and the global CORSA framework creates a significant risk of double accounting, which could lead to valuation uncertainty and stifle the large-scale capital deployment needed to scale SAF.
Investors are going to find it very hard to commit billions when the math might not even add up.
Precisely.
Brazilian regulators need to finalize the traceability rules for carbon credits before the capital dries up. Watch for any new friction between the Renova Bio and CORSIA frameworks, because if the accounting doesn't align, the investment will stall. But does this regulatory chaos in the energy sector extend to the actual mechanics of how these commodities are traded on the floor? I was looking at my grocery receipt this morning and realized I'm basically paying a real-time premium for global weather patterns. It's getting impossible to ignore how much the commodity part of our economy is actually just a massive, invisible game of high-stakes poker.
It really is, especially as the lines between political prediction and physical commodity trading are blurring. We're seeing this Avengers model of trading as noted on Bloomberg Surveillance, where decentralized groups of specialists use private Discord servers to aggregate niche intelligence, effectively acting like a fragmented multi-strategy hedge fund without the institutional overhead.
So instead of a mahogany boardroom, we just have a bunch of guys in hoodies betting on wheat yields and election results in the same chat room. That sounds efficient.
It's more about the accountability. In these markets, you face direct financial consequences for being wrong, which creates a much sharper incentive for accuracy than traditional bank consensus. You can even see it in how traders are outperforming Bloomberg by performing a bottoms-up reconstruction of BLS inflation formulas in Excel to track the specific weights of the 200-plus subcategories in the consumer basket.
But doesn't that volatility just make everything more expensive for the rest of us? It feels like speculators are just driving the price of bread into the stratosphere.
Actually, the market sees it differently. Harold DeBoer argues that high energy and food prices serve as essential price discovery mechanisms that incentivize societal shifts, like using less gas, to prevent even worse shortages later. The real danger isn't the speculators, but the safety fences regulators put up to limit price swings. DeBoer suggests these fences actually increase systemic risk by masking the accumulation of risk, which eventually leads to much more violent, catastrophic market breaks when the fence finally snaps.
Right, because nothing says stable economy like suppressing volatility until it explodes like a pressurized keg.
Two things stand out. And you can't use standard models to predict it either. Systematic strategies have to avoid Gaussian assumptions because commodity markets are inherently asymmetric. Natural disasters or crop failures drive upward price spikes much more frequently than surpluses drive collapses. This creates a fat tail risk that is often hidden because 0 days, like the lack of movement on weekends, artificially inflate the appearance of stability in your data.
So if you're holding wheat, you're essentially paying a continuous tax on the possibility of a drought.
We can trace that further, as DeBoer points out, the sustainable return isn't in being long, where you pay a continuous risk premium, but in being short to carry that specific risk.
Active management is the only way to stay alive. Watch the next major agricultural supply shock to see if those regulatory fences hold or if they finally shatter. But if the very mechanics of how we price resources is shifting, does that mean the fundamental strength of the US dollar is also up for grabs? We all thought the era of the global commodity price was a permanent fixture, but looking at the cracks in the dollar, it feels like the world is breaking into a dozen different, very expensive pieces.
That's exactly what's happening with the fragmentation of markets. The HC Commodities podcast notes that the era of unified pricing is ending, replaced by regional dislocations driven by deglobalization. You saw this clearly when the 2025 Trump tariff threats caused US inventories to swell as players moved metal to avoid duties.
Instead of one global price for copper or oil, we're just playing a high-stakes game of where can I hide my stuff to avoid a tax bill.
Worth noting that fragmentation is being fueled by a structural shift in how we hold value. As Macro Musings with David Beckworth highlights, the 21st century shift toward a multipolar monetary system is being driven by reduced transaction costs via smartphones, which weakens the network effects that used to make it too difficult to trade in anything but the dollar.
It's much easier to abandon a reserve currency when you can do it via a banking app while waiting for your latte.
It's more than just convenience, though. It's about the three Ds: de-dollarization, debasement, and diversification. The HC Commodities podcast points out that gold's massive surge, climbing from $2,000 to over $5,000, is driven by a fundamental break in the traditional relationship between gold, the dollar, and real interest rates, triggered specifically by the 2022 freezing of Russian assets. This weaponization of the dollar has turned gold into the ultimate hedge against sovereign risk.
So the US uses the dollar as a club, and now every central bank is frantically buying gold as a shield.
The implication runs deeper. The pressure is mounting internally too. Macro Musings with David Beckworth suggests a new Triffin dilemma. The US cannot indefinitely provide global liquidity because its ability to supply dollar-denominated assets is strictly constrained by its domestic fiscal capacity to service its mounting debt.
It's a bit of a squeeze then. The US needs to fund its debt while the world looks for an exit ramp. Energy traders need to recalibrate their hedging strategies for a world of regional price premiums rather than global benchmarks. Keep a close eye on the next U.S. Treasury auction for any sign that the debt servicing costs are finally breaking the Fed-Treasury accord. As we wrap up this edition, the thread connecting everything we've discussed today, from Meta's massive 5-gigawatt Louisiana project to the soaring price of gold, is the physical reality of the digital age. We are witnessing the fundamental conversion of software dreams into heavy metal requirements. The era of asset-light tech is evaporating, replaced by a relentless demand for copper, steel, and high-voltage cables, all of which are currently caught in a supply-side bottleneck that has seen component costs triple since 2019.
Something to flag here, the cross-cutting implication here isn't just about tech valuations. It's about the shifting calculus for the global utilities and sovereign debt holders. The massive capital expenditure required to meet the projected 400-gigawatt demand means that for the first time, the bottleneck for AI growth isn't compute or code, but the ability of the electrical grid to scale. For decision-makers in the energy sector, the mission has shifted from merely managing transition to preventing a total failure of operational stability as the gap between high-speed silicon deployment and slow-moving utility infrastructure widens.
It's a high-stakes environment where the inflationary pressures from energy components and the geopolitical fragmentation of commodity pricing are converging. We are moving from a world of unified global markets to one of regionalized, resource-heavy clusters.
If you want to know if this structural shift is accelerating or hitting a wall, keep a very close eye on the mid-cap semiconductor earnings reports coming out next month. If these smaller players can maintain their growth margins despite the rising costs of the physical supply chain, it confirms that this hardware-centric build-out is a permanent structural pivot rather than a temporary speculative surge.
Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday edition of the Weekly Digest. We'll see you again next week.